Okay, Senate Resources is called to order. We do have a quorum to conduct business consisting of Senator Steven Stedman, Co-Chairman Willakowski, and Senator Wagner. It's the 30th of March. It is 3:35, and we do have two items on the agenda today. The first is SJR 13 pertaining to the law of the sea by our committee here. The second is HJR 21 pertaining to groundfish fisheries licenses by Representative Osterman. So we'll go ahead and start with SJR 13, and we do have Eric, Senator Willakowski's intern, who I understand has been hard at work on this issue over the last few weeks, and we want to say welcome to the committee, and we're delighted to have interns in the building working on policy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, through the chair. For the record, my name is Eric Lund. I'm an intern, as you mentioned, for Senator Bill Willakowski, and I'm here today to talk about Senate Joint Resolution 13. This resolution urges the U.S. Senate to ratify the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea Treaty, also known as the Law of the Sea Treaty. This treaty was formed in 1982 to replace outdated laws governing the world's oceans, and the intent of the treaty is to provide a legal framework that addresses ocean activities such as economic development, claim disputes, maritime activities, scientific research, environmental protection, and defense. Currently, 155 countries have ratified the treaty, while the U.S. remains the only Arctic nation yet to ratify. This treaty recognizes a country's right to a 12 nautical mile territorial sea and a 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone, which the U.S. has maintained over the years in compliance, that is, voluntarily compliance. In this area, countries have sovereign rights over natural resources like oil and gas, and I'm speaking of the 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone. Coastal nations are allowed to make claims beyond the 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone if they meet certain provisions, such as proving that there is a seabed extension beyond this area. The United States' non-member status means that it cannot make any claims until ratification. Recent studies suggest that a seabed off Alaska's coast could be about the size of California and extend beyond this 200 mile zone. The Arctic contains a significant amount of oil and natural gas, which presents a tremendous amount of opportunities for Alaska, since it is the United States' link to the Arctic. With recent Arctic melt opening up waterways that regular ships could not previously pass through, there are valuable routes open for maritime activities. Ratifying this treaty would also help the U.S. defend its jurisdiction over a portion of the Beaufort Sea that is currently in dispute with Canada. In 1994, Bill Clinton signed the treaty. However, the Senate did not ratify it. In 2007, President George W. Bush called on the Senate to ratify the treaty, and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee demonstrated overwhelming support with a 17-4 vote. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich both favor ratification. In fact, earlier this year, Senator Lisa Murkowski announced her support for ratification, highlighting the great economic potential that serves Alaska's interests. It is imperative that we urge the U.S. Senate to ratify the Law of the Sea Treaty because of the significant economic potential as well as the security to other American interests that will benefit as a result. If the U.S. does not ratify this treaty, we are left out of participation as well as future policy decisions that directly affect us. And I do have three members that should be on the line to answer any questions that may come up that I may not be able to answer.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Lund. We appreciate it. Questions? Senator Wagner.
You referred to three members. Three members of what? Who are the people on the line?
Yes, I have Commander James Kraska, Navy Professor of International Law. Meade Treadwell, Chair of the Arctic Research Commission, and Buck Sharpton, Vice Chancellor for Research at University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Okay. So what we're showing, just for the members, as of yet, maybe the other two gentlemen will join. For now, we have James Kraska, who's with the Navy War College. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I know that when General Atkins was here giving a presentation to the Joint Armed Services Committee, he specifically mentioned that the importance of ratifying this treaty. And are you aware of other high-ranking military members in the United States military who have voiced support for this passage as well?
Yes, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I have a document here that I can pass out. I don't believe it's in the packet, but it has a number of high-ranking officials from numerous military branches.
Thank you.
And Senator French has joined us. Senator French, and then Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate Mr. Lund and Senator Wilikowski bringing this measure forward. I had the opportunity this summer to meet a gentleman by the name of Scott Borgerson. He's a visiting fellow for Ocean Governance at the Council on Foreign Relations. He and I have stayed in contact since I met him this summer. He recently sent me both a article that is going to appear in next month's Foreign Affairs, as well as testimony he gave in front of Congress recently. And he made many of the points that Mr. Lund just made, that the law of the sea includes provisions for extending U.S. sovereignty over its extended continental shelf. It defends our position with respect to the Northwest Passage and establishes title rules for managing the Bering Sea, which will become a key shipping choke point, and also protecting the maneuverability of U.S. flagged vessels. It's just a great idea. I guess my question is given the overwhelming number of people who support this, and this is a really fantastic document, who's opposed to this? Who is fighting the ratification of the Law of the Sea Treaty?
Senator French, the chair. As I mentioned, there are 155 countries that have become signatories to the treaty, the U.S. being not one of them. I don't have a list of countries that have yet to sign on in addition to the U.S. However, I can provide you with that information later if you'd like. I guess to answer that question is this has become more recently a more pressing issue with Arctic melt, especially opening up Arctic waterways that were normally frozen over, and thus normal regular ships cannot pass through. Part of the reason just has to do with the fact that before there wasn't this many countries supporting it, and there's a lot of myths about the Law of the Sea Treaty, which particularly one of the main ones is that it gives up the United States' sovereign rights. However, when you look at the details of this treaty, it actually allows the United States official recognition and a strong position on the International Seaboard Authority. And so it does if it does sign on, it really can participate in discussions and vote on important decisions, which currently it's not allowed to because of its non-member status.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Stevens, and Senator Huggins has joined us.
Thank you. Having read through this, I just can't help but think I'm missing something here. The United States Senate is not a foolish body, but they have chosen not to ratify. Why has that? Why is that? Why is the United States Senate not ready to ratify? There must be some rationale there, some reasons. Are they entirely misguided or wrong? What's your position on that?
The research that I have found is there are members that still hold the belief that this may threaten the sovereign rights, and one argument against it is that it will give up, it will impede on military activities. However, this has been proven false. In fact, I have a document here with a number of high-ranking military officials that say that previous or current laws and treaties already protect military practices, and that the military finds this a priority to ratify. And in 1994, there were amendments made to the seabed mining provisions, which initially there were issues raised by President Ronald Reagan. and however those issues were cleared up. And for instance, one of the issues was that there was a clause that required mandatory technology transfers, in which certain equipment for mining would be required to be shared among other nations to allow equal opportunities. However, as it stands, that has been abolished, and there is no longer that clause or others that require sharing of equipment. And so the United States would actually have exclusive access to resources within the 200-mile exclusive economic zone, and if they ratify, they'll be able to expand the zone. And I would just like to clarify that the as it stands now, we're in voluntary compliance with the territorial sea and the 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone. However, we're not allowed to expand that because we're not a member country.
Okay, and Senator Wagner.
Yeah, I have some of the same, something tickles the back of my neck about this. And I'm wondering who becomes subservient to who if we become a signatory on the laws of the sea? Are we subservient then to a government such as the United Nations or an organization such as the United Nations? What's the pecking order?
Well, as it stands, this basically the way it operates is the treaty serves as an agreement for countries to come together and work out in a peaceful means provisions of this treaty and to comply with it. The United States, since the 94 amendments, has been guaranteed a strong position on the International Seabed Authority. I believe it's the Council. And its interest would, through other laws and other treaties, would protect it. It's, as with other treaties, when you have overlap, some of the provisions do not necessarily come into effect because another treaty or another law already reserves that right, such as with military practices. And so I think that that's another belief that some people may hold, is that this would put the United States in an inferior position. However, because the United States would be able to lay claim to vast amounts of land if it were a member, and to manage this area as members of this, they do not serve as an inferior role. So there is no country that dominates, but the United States would certainly have a strong position being on the International Seaboard Authority. Does that answer your question?
Senator Wagner?
Probably as good an answer as we can get right now. Mm-hmm. But I sometimes wonder about laying claim to anything that's outside of the 200-mile limit. That's never been done before other than this law of the sea. And right now, our 200-mile limit, it's an exclusive zone. But we still have to spend millions of dollars a year policing that zone with our Coast Guard and other assets to make sure people respect that zone. And a lot of times, they don't respect that zone. As a matter of fact, on a fairly regular basis, we're arresting people and confiscating vessels because people violate that zone and violate our fishing laws and everything. So I don't know where this gets us over and above what we already have at our 200-mile limit.
And we do have Mead Treadwell and James Kraska online. And if you want to wrap up real quickly, I'd like to get to them to hear their perspective as well.
If I may respond, Madam Chair, Senator Wagner, through the chair, the position that the United States is in with its voluntary compliance actually puts it at quite a bit of risk of other countries violating its laws because it's not an official member. And it also gives way for other countries to potentially make claims that are actually in U.S. jurisdiction because the U.S. is closed off from making such claims or disputing them. Thank you.
So, Mr. Kraska, you were online first. Have you been following the discussion? And could you make some comments? And then I'll go next to you, Mead, if you could also make some comments. The general concern on the part of Senator Stevens and Wagner and certainly members of the committee is just why would the United States Senate have rejected it the first time that President Clinton brought it forward? And then in the second time, it looks like President Bush brought it forward and the Senate did support it, but for some reason or another, it did not make it successfully through Congress. And so the question is, you know, on sovereignty and some of these concerns out there, if you could give some insight.
Sure, yes, ma'am, thank you. The treaty was opposed primarily because of the Part 11 on seabed mining. And the treaty essentially represents a grand bargain, and it reduces to writing a grand bargain between the maritime states and coastal states. And the creeping jurisdiction that some coastal states have pursued for about 100 years, and in particular after World War II, that is to try to close off large areas of the oceans to the international community. So as a result, the Law of the Sea Convention was negotiated in the 1970s, and the main provisions of the convention protected all of those navigational rights, and that's why the Department of Defense has strongly supported it, and the Navy has. And the letter that I provided is signed by the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and all the service chiefs. The opposition to the treaty has come, and going back to Ronald Reagan in 1982, came from Part 11 on seabed mining, in which the Law of the Sea Convention sets up this international seabed authority to regulate seabed mining beyond 200 nautical miles from every country's coastline. And that Part 11 really emerged out of the kind of the 70s socialist new international economic order, and it was pushed by the group of 77 developing countries at the time. It was, because it was a problem for the United States and other countries, it was revised in 1994, and most of the, or really all of the major offensive provisions in that part on seabed mining were eliminated, because in the meantime the Berlin Wall had come down, and so the seabed mining regime adopted market-oriented principles. Well, 1994 was also the year that Senator Jesse Helms was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he was there for about a decade, and he opposed the treaty, and so he would not bring it before the committee. And that was just a general disagreement with a large multilateral treaty that was negotiated by the United Nations. Most of the if all of the objections are really display kind of a lack of understanding of the treaty and American interests, everything from the environment to fishing, oil and gas, and of course national security that are promoted by the convention. So after Senator Helms stepped down from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the treaty came before Senator Lugar in 2004, and Senator Lugar strongly supported it, and it was voted out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee 19-0. But at the time, Senator Frist did not take it to a full vote of the Senate because it was opposed by some on the right, and it had become somewhat of a fundraising issue on the right. So another attempt was made in 2007, and that's when it was voted out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee 17-4. And that was the last action that was taken on it. So the bottom line is, it's a multilateral treaty. It's the most comprehensive treaty in existence after the UN Charter. Every major oceans interest in the US government and on the civilian side supports the treaty, but the opposition is generally relates to just a fear that the international organizations, there's three of them, they're set up under the convention, will try to assume too much power. And I'll end with, some of the problems really are fanciful, like things like there's going to be a UN Navy, or the UN is taking over the oceans. As a matter of fact, as was already mentioned, the treaty really does permit the United States to make an extended continental shelf claim. Now, that's not a sovereignty claim, but there's a fine distinction. It allows the United States to assert sovereign rights and jurisdiction over the seabed that is coterminous with the extended continental margin or continental shelf underneath the ocean. And so we would be entitled to all of the oil and gas and minerals. We'd have exclusive rights to do that. All the other areas throughout the seabed would be managed by the International Seabed Authority. And that authority would charge essentially a fee or a levy in order for multinational corporations or conglomerates to access seabed minerals and oil and gas. And that is really the primary objections, is that some people think that if it's out in the middle of the ocean and you find it, you ought to keep it. You ought to be able to keep it, rather than go through the International Seabed Authority. I could go on, but you probably that was more than you wanted.
Questions for Mr. Kreska. Senator Wagner.
Yeah, I just off the cuff. How about a scenario where Shell Oil, instead of wanting to drill in the Beaufort Sea, wants to drill 285 miles off the coast of Alaska? What is the process going to be that Shell Oil will have to go through in order to drill there, with or without this treaty being in effect in the United States?
Yeah, what they'll have to do is they would, if we are not a party to the treaty, Shell Oil effectively cannot do so. And the reason why is because they would not have security of legal tenure. Shell Oil is a multinational corporation in 100 or so countries around the world, let's say, probably more. And so it could be sued in the courts of any of those countries that are party to the Law of the Sea Convention, 156 countries plus the European Union. So because of that risk, Shell Oil couldn't just say, hey, we're going to go do our Exxon. We're just going to go do whatever we want and disregard it because the U.S. is not a party. Because they're a multinational corporation, they'll be sued in another country. They'll be sued in France or Brazil or somewhere. If we are in the treaty and it's a U.S. company, then they would do like every other company. They would approach the International Seabed Authority. They would say, we have determined that this site might be lucrative. And there are some fairly marginal fees associated with claiming a mining site, and then they also have to assist the International Seabed Authority in developing an equally valuable site. And then the funds are taken by the International Seabed Authority, and they can be distributed for international economic development. But the United States is guaranteed a seat on the council of the International Seabed Authority that distributes those funds, and the council, which has 36 members, will distribute those funds based upon a consensus basis. And the United States is guaranteed a seat in perpetuity because the provision in the convention says that the country with the largest economy at the time that the treaty came into force, which was 1994, has a seat on the council. So in effect, we have kind of a permanent veto on how those funds, those development funds that are extracted from the seabed mining fees or levies would be distributed. And it's a fairly reasonable amount. It's about 7% over the life of a 20-year life of an oil well, for example. So it's not exorbitant cost. But this gets translated by some who are just opposed to, they see some of the problems and the abuses at the UN, and they just say, well, this is a UN tax. Now you're subjecting American corporations to a United Nations tax, and they don't like it. But it's really, you know, if this were 1940 or 1950, and you wanted to craft or design a better approach, then I think you could do so with seabed mining. On the other hand, it's not, and and given that there's 156 countries in the European Union, the law of the sea convention has already moved into the domain of customary international law. In other words, it can be binding even if the United States is not a party. And we've seen that in U.S. courts, where U.S. courts have viewed the treaty as a binding set of legal regimes, even though we're not a party. And you'll certainly see it overseas in foreign courts.
Okay, any further questions? Okay, Mead, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Good. I hope Mr. Kraska stays on, because I've often relied on his writing and his speaking for my understanding, and I'm sure that he will correct any misunderstanding that I have in this statement. For purpose of the record, my name is Mead Treadwell. I live in Anchorage at 528 N Street. I'm testifying today also in my capacity as chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission. Madam Chair, as you know, the commission is seven members appointed by the president, which works with the federal research agencies as well as the state of Alaska and other nations on our $400 million a year research program in the Arctic. And the timing of what's happening with Law of the Sea is very interesting, because not only do we have this treaty, which has now come into force and people are beginning to carve up the extended continental shelf of the Arctic Ocean, but it's coincident with a much greater understanding and perception that the Arctic Ocean is now an accessible ocean. And it was for that reason that our commission went to the White House 2 years ago and said we'd like to see a review of U.S. Arctic policy, and that was one of the last documents that left the Bush administration, but it has been supported so far by the Obama administration, and the United States is going out on several objectives here to implement that policy. And a bedrock of that policy is that we need to ratify Law of the Sea. It's important because without being a member of the convention, we're not at the table as other parts of the Arctic Ocean are carved up. We do have the chance to add to the United States over two Californias in extended continental shelf. Doing this may help, and this is where I'm hoping Mr. Kraska can help me. We have unfinished boundaries to be resolved between us and Canada, north of the Yukon border, and between us and Russia, in the Bering Strait and north of the Bering Strait. It would give the United States capability to manage the living resources offshore outside the 200-mile limit, and as you know, the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council just put a moratorium on fishing in our 200-mile limit in the ocean as we're watching fish stocks move up, and we need to get good ecological baseline information. It would give us the rights to the economic resources of the territory on the ocean, or of the on the ocean floor in the extended continental shelf, that we can legally claim under Law of the Sea. And Article 234 of the Law of the Sea allows us to extend certain kinds of environmental regulation into the exclusive economic zone in traditional ice-covered waters, and that may be important for the United States to protect against rust bucket ships and others that might be sailing this newly accessible ocean without concern for the risks of oil spills. So from the Commission standpoint, we don't normally take a position on legislation of this kind, except that we got involved very early because this has been a major driver for Arctic research, and it is also going to add significant Arctic resources to the ledger of the United States. For Alaska, we urged Governor Palin to send the letter that she did now over a year ago in support of it, and have worked with the congressional delegation to try to mitigate objections to the law and to the Law of the Sea. And we are also co-sponsoring a major conference on this issue in Seward in mid-May, where the Center for Law and Oceans Policy, headed by one of the negotiators of the Law of the Sea Treaty, will be bringing experts from all over the world to Seward to focus on the value of law and sea in the Arctic, to which I'd invite members of the committee or the legislature if you're interested. But the last point I would make is that without us being at the table, some of the challenges, and I think your resolution speaks to it very well, in Senator Wachowski's draft, Without being at the table, some of the minor problems that we have with Law of the Sea, and one is major for us in the research business, we can't really be there to fix. And I was recalcitrant in supporting a resolution of our own commission before this, and it was after long discussions with John Norton Moore and Senator Ted Stevens and others that we decided to go ahead. And it is by being at the table on Law of the Sea, we think we can get improvements in terms of scientific access and some of the other issues that people have. And by holding back at this point, I don't think we will. So for that reason, Madam Chair, I'm glad the legislature is considering a resolution in support of ratification, and I hope it does pass.
Thank you very much, Mr. Treadwell. Senator Wagner.
I'd just like to ask either one of the gentlemen who just spoke to us on the net, is there any poison pill that you can see either side of this issue at this time?
I'll take a stab at it. By poison pill, do you mean is there something that we're going to sign up for that we're going to be sorry later?
Absolutely.
I think in large part, no. I think, this will be the largest addition to American territory since the Louisiana Purchase. It gives us, by and large, the power to regulate those resources offshore that if we didn't, somebody else would for us.
Yes, I absolutely concur with that. One of the things that's been cited from the military standpoint is that there is a mandatory dispute resolution process in the Law of the Sea, and including an international tribunal on the Law of the Sea as well as arbitration. And there's been concerns expressed by some that are not entirely fantastic concerns, and that is that sometimes international tribunals don't necessarily go our way. And one of the problems that they've cited is that other countries could attempt to regulate U.S. naval activity off their coasts in the exclusive economic zone. And as you know, the exclusive economic zone is open for high seas freedoms and overflight by foreign military vessels. And the United States exercises those rights all over the world. As a global naval power, we're dependent upon those rights. You may have seen about a week or two ago an incident with the USNS Impeccable off the coast of China, which was over this very issue. And so the fear from some is that a country like China would take the United States to one of these tribunals, and we would lose because of an interpretation within the Law of the Sea Convention that we do not concur with. But ultimately, if an international tribunal oversteps its bounds, then the United States just wouldn't recognize the jurisdiction. And military vessels and aircraft have sovereign immune status, and so a tribunal would not be entitled to try to assert jurisdiction over our military activities. So that's one of these sort of false claims that that some people might suggest poses a problem, but it really does not. It really would not.
Senator Wagner, if I could add one other thing. I initially, as many members of the legislature know, and as a senior fellow at the Institute of the North, we've worked pretty hard, worked with Senator Wilkowski last year on a resolution related to missile defense. And there had been some concern by advocates of missile defense that some precedent set with Law of the Sea might pose a problem for us in that. One of the reasons why I really appreciate the fact that Mr. Kraska is on the line today is because he, in his last job at the Pentagon, helped sort through the military issues with a fine-tooth comb, and essentially after that, the Joint Chiefs gave this treaty a bill of health, a clean bill of health. So I think that's very important that we understand that.
That's absolutely true that the senior Pentagon leadership has been briefed on this. Every chief of naval operations since 1994 has supported the convention and all throughout, so the submarine force, the the aviation community, because we understand, and logistics as well, we understand that freedom of navigation, global mobility and maneuverability and access beyond 12 nautical miles throughout the world, as well as the ability to transit through international straits like the Straits of Malacca, and the Strait of Hormuz, all of those are guaranteed in the Law of the Sea Convention. And, you know, critics could say, well, a country like Iran, maybe they won't comply with the Law of the Sea Convention. And, in fact, Iran does have some positions that are inconsistent with the Law of the Sea Convention. They are also not a party. Nonetheless, it's far easier. We have much greater authority, and we expend far fewer resources when we're operating under color of law, so to speak. When we have greater legitimacy, and you know that's just as important, if not more important, really, because you can't shoot your way into every place on the planet. And you know we have disagreements with friendly countries like Australia and Canada, and so it's very much in our interest that this treaty guarantees or ensures a very liberal regime of freedom of navigation for our commercial vessels as well as for our naval forces. If we were negotiating this treaty today, we could not likely get that generous navigational provision, for transiting throughout the world. We probably would not be able to get that today.
Interesting. Okay, further questions?
One other point, if I may,
yes.
Along that line, and that is, remember, this came about in 1982, and the major maritime powers supported all of those navigational provisions, and that meant that at the time, at the height of the Cold War, in the late 70s, the United States and the Soviet Union both were in complete agreement on this, because the Soviets realized that they were zone locked and that they needed navigational freedom as much or more than we did. And so it was really the U.S., the Soviet Union, France, the U.K., and Japan that really worked on ensuring navigational freedom throughout the globe, and we got it in the treaty. And now the U.S. and Russia, likely because of the rise of other countries that have more of a coastal state interest, likely would have less influence than we did back then.
Interesting perspective. Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen, for your testimony. It looks like we have Jim Floyd in Tok.
Yes, ma'am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right. Thank you, Senate Resources Committee. Thank you for taking my testimony today. Greetings from Tok. I'd like to say a few things against this particular treaty, not particularly against the bill, but against the treaty itself. Some concerns, oh, by the way, I speak on behalf of myself, some concerns that have come up in the past. One is that in the packet that you received, there was myths and reality. If you'll notice in that packet, it was from the written testimony of John Negroponte back in 2007. However, the actual meeting that occurred, it was interesting watching how Mr. Negroponte reacted to some of the questions and seemed to not really be sure of a lot of answers. So there's some additional information there. What I see as a citizen is this particular thing seems to be coming down from the top. There are news articles out saying the executive branch is for it. A lot of people in Congress are for it. The only people that don't seem to know anything about it are your average citizens. I would encourage this committee to please investigate some of the things that are against this particular treaty. There are a lot of legal arguments against it. The Twin Bill HR 22, the sponsor statement itself, uses terms like compulsory submission to international arbitration. Another term, international tribunal, has exclusive jurisdiction. It states that the states themselves are liable for pollution, land-based pollution. There's a lot of little holes in this that I'd like to just kind of point out, and I would just urge committee to actually try to thoroughly investigate the cons to this actual treaty. When I was listening to the House House version, which occurred a couple weeks ago, it was almost like watching the Senate Relations Committee back in 2007. It was the same exact scenario. You had the military come out. They favored it, of course, but then there were some key concerns that came up a little bit later in that. So the treaty itself, by the way, says that states shall pass laws in accordance with the treaty, and I guess my question is, since when is there an authority above the federal government, or what something that dictates? I've also heard the argument that you've got to give up something to get something. As I understand it, the treaty would apparently subjugate the U.S. to international control on the same level as the U.S. Constitution, and this causes me deep concern. And so I would ask that the committee weigh this, and I thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Floyd. The last person I have is Stephen Toffin in Kodiak.
Yes, thank you, Senator McGuire and Senator Wilichowski and members of the committee. I'm actually in Anchorage this afternoon. We made it in under the volcano ash. And I wanted to ask you first, did you receive a copy of my written submittal? Is it possible to get an answer, Senator?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm hoping that this goes in the docket. In general, I support a United States ratification of UNCLOS, United Nations Convention on Law of the Sea. But things are quite interesting in this world today. And this convention was put together, the concerns of military and and geophysical sovereignty were at a time when trade around the world was conducted differently than it is today. And while this convention may be mature in a host of areas, I hope that you do exercise care not to become a horse that's led to water that you can't drink from. The caveat is that this bill does not, or the convention does not recognize modern realities and the new knowledge in the conduct of trade, both in an area of globalized casino economics and how quickly that evolved, beginning with the Asian financial crisis in 1997 and the 2008 United States financial crisis, and during an era when transnational corporations today now own hundreds of international subsidiaries to trade in those resources. And, if you were to read the National Intelligence Council's 2025 report, that's the kind of mentality we need to engage in. This is 2025 already. We are going to be considering, as nations, more strategic national resource protections. And the old dogs who developed this never had a chance to chew on these new fortified bones that might become jawbreakers. There's a lot that I say in my paper on fisheries, and I hope that everyone gets a chance to read it. And I'm concerned, and maybe Mr. Kraska can answer a question about, would there also be fees on fisheries? Because what's happened today is multinational enterprises have found means to actually close off the economics, to close off our seas here in the United States in large part, such that it at least controls the price making. And this is about economics. And I hope that the role of the people is to exercise the authority over the military and over these other conducts covered by the bill. And I would warn you that fisheries are already an area of armed conflict around the world. But I just don't know how to say it in 3 minutes, but I hope you please read my paper that talks about the international trade aspects. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Toffin, and members do have copies of your testimony in front of them now. Anyone else online that I've overlooked to testify on SJR 13? Is there anyone here in the audience? Okay, hearing and seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony and set SJR 13 to the side so that we can go ahead and get to HJR 21.
Chairman.
Oh, yes, Senator Huggins.
Can I just make a couple comments?
Absolutely.
Number one, thank you. And it's very interesting tidbits of information. And I'm all for cooperation nationally and internationally. But I would just ask us to think about the history of where we are and where we've been. Once upon a time, being a soldier, one of our policies, national policies, is we don't place our soldiers under UN command. And that may have changed over the last, but because of concerns about what happens to U.S. kind of things when somebody else has control over it, and I'll let somebody else explain that. But in the UN, I think most of us understand the Security Council and how the permanent members and being able to veto and how it turns into, generally speaking, gridlock. And then I bring us back to, as you remember, when Kofi Annan was the Secretary General, we had a program whereby we were dealing with Iraq and the petrol marketing system and food and aid to the country. And we remember all those people that worked for the UN that got caught up in that and how they were doing all these sweetheart deals under the auspices of the UN. And I'm one of those people not against the UN, but I would just remind you, maybe is anybody here around the table or in the room ever worked with the UN? It's kind of interesting. My first experience with them was adjacent to the Golan Heights, between Israel and the surrounding countries, particularly when you Lebanon and Syria. But I remember my mouth fell open because the UN was driving Mercedes vehicles. It's kind of interesting to me to see. I mean, that's a first-class vehicle internationally. It's known as a status symbol, and here's a group that we're paying for them to drive Mercedes, huge Mercedes vehicles. Now, I take that a step further in the sense that while I was in that part of the country, we had a peacekeeping force that was designed so the UN would not be involved in it. And it was called the Multinational Force and Observers, and it had lots of UN kinds of people, but it was done so that UN would not be a part of it because of some of the neighboring countries and their concern about what the UN does or does not do. And finally, I would just want to make sure that all of us understand that there are countries that their profession in life is supplying people, military and professional bureaucrats to work in the UN. That's all they do. They transfer from UN job to UN job to UN job. Most of them are very nice people. They get some very bad habits. And I mentioned things to you like the Geneva Convention. We're signatures to the Geneva Convention. How often do you remember saying, well, the people that we're dealing with, we're fighting with, they're not bound by the Geneva Convention because they didn't sign it. And we can't put down whatever it turns out to be that being objected to because we signed the Geneva Convention. Geneva Convention is a wonderful thing, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't be signatures to it, but there are a lot of people that aren't. And you're bound by some things that maybe we never thought about. Status of Forces Agreement. We essentially cannot reach a Status of Forces Agreement with Iraq. And there we are as the country trying to help them out because they want certain prerogatives over our soldiers and sailors and airmen that are there. They want to be able to take control of them under circumstances. And our country's position, for the most part, in situations like that is, no, we don't allow that because you become a hostage of the host nation. So in any event, it's kind of like, why do people that drive ships around across the international waters, why do they register their ships in Liberia, in Panama? Because there are some benefits that how you're not bound by things. And quite frankly, I would just ask us to to realize that there aren't any silver bullets when you sign up for things. And if you talk to the captain of the Pueblo that was held in North Korea, where was the UN? What did they do? I mean, and they were supposedly in international waters. Not sure about that. But those people were kept there, captives for many, many months and treated very, very harshly. And we're signatures to all sorts of things, and I'm not sure where what the North Koreans are or are not signatures to, but the point being is that these large organizations that, like the UN, that are, quote, going to be the panacea, we used to have the League of Nations. It went away because it was ineffective, and now we have the United Nations. Some people aren't confident in that. My point is that I'm assuming this seabed authority, which has 36 members, that we give up some prerogatives, maybe some significant prerogatives. We need to make sure we understand what those prerogatives are before we sign up, for lots of reasons that I didn't mention that I know nothing about. But I know there's a reason we aren't signed up for this. I'm not sure what it is, but let's make sure we understand some of them before we sign up.
Absolutely. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, and fair points. And that's why I'm particularly heartened by the June 26, 2000 letter from the chairman, vice chairman, and I believe every member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under President Bush signing on and saying that becoming a party to the convention will ensure our leadership role in the continuing development of oceans law and policy. And so I... and also stating that this convention furthers our national security strategy, strengthens the coalition, and supports the president's proliferation security initiative. So I have a high degree of confidence in our military that they certainly wouldn't be signing on urging us to sign on to a treaty that would threaten our troops or our sovereignty in any way.
Okay, with that, thank you for the statements by the members and those that testified. We'll set SJR 13 to the side and bring up HJR 21. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Lund.
Hey, members of the committee, thank you.
So, Representative Osterman. Welcome to Senate Resources. And tell us about HJR 21, please.
Chairman McGuire and Wilkowski, members of the Resource Committee, thank you for taking up HJR 21 today. I appreciate it very much. My name is Alan Osterman. I'm the representative from District 36, which is Kodiak Island and the Lake and Penn area. HJR 21 is a message that we're trying to trying to send to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. Most of you have heard of things like the halibut IFQ program, where the halibut were taken and given as a quota-based program where individual fishermen ended up basically owning the resource. You've heard recently in reference to the crab rationalization program that took place in the Bering Sea, which took that crab resource and basically gave it to the crab fishermen and to the processing industry that were processing crab at the time. Some of you may not have heard of the American Fisheries Act, which took the Bering Sea pollock and turned it over to seven or eight different processors and owners of large catcher processor vessels. The North Pacific Fishery Management Council has a history of taking the resource and either reducing it down to where that resource is owned, basically owned by the individual fishermen who are there, and or the access rights to them are so restricted that the normal fishermen, for example, in the halibut industry cannot get into the industry right now. A young upstart fisherman who wants to get started would have to invest, in the estimates that are out there, in the neighborhood of $750,000 to $1 million to get into the industry. And those are based upon the fact that when they did the halibut and they gave away these resources in the IFQ system to a number of people who quote, had catch history, the average price at that point in time of the quota when they did it was somewhere in the $2 to $3 a pound. Today, it's I looked at the newspaper the other day and I saw $26 a pound that if you want to buy quota to go fishing, you have to pay $26 a pound for it. And then you take that quota and you go out and try to amortize that over a number of years, obviously. But it's very, very expensive. Now, obviously, the vessels and the gear and everything else that go on top of that. The North Pacific Council, up until 2006, were moving in the same direction in what we call the Gulf of Alaska cod fishery. And in 2006, when our current governor was elected, she asked them to not do that, not give that resource away, to not rationalize that fishery in the terms of rationalization of giving the resource or the access rights to individuals. The council at that time did take a 180-degree turn to their credit, and they put together a limited license program and have gone that direction right now. The limited license program is a groundfish limited license program where you can fish, you have the right to fish in the Gulf of Alaska, both in western and central Gulf of Alaska for groundfish. The number one species that people catch within that fisheries is cod. So what we're really talking today about is cod. And those permits that were given out were based upon catch history back in the late 1990s. So they gave out these permits and these limited license permits. And there's about 800 and some of them in the Gulf of Alaska, in the central Gulf of Alaska, that were given out. And you could have landed one fish, or you could have landed 10,000, or you could have made a whole, all different species or spectrums of catch history was used to give out these licenses. So there is a lot of licenses out there. Currently, about 65% of those licenses are latent, what they call latent, and are not being used and haven't been used for quite some time. A lot of them probably never will be used again. So the North Pacific Council, after 2006, came up with this idea that we would set up a catch history for people who had used these licenses during a period of time, and it could be from 2000 to 2006 or 2002 to 2008. There's a number of series of options that the council was looking at and how they're going to determine who those licenses would go, the current licenses would go to, and which license they would eliminate. After a lot of hollering and screaming, the council has now said, well, we're not going to get rid of those licenses, but what we're going to do is those current fishermen who have catch history during this same period of time, either depending on which option they use, we will put a cod endorsement on this groundfish license. So those people who get the endorsements are the only ones who will have licenses to fish cod in the Gulf of Alaska. Now, obviously, if you're a fisherman during this time period, or a current fisherman, and this is a great thing for you. All of a sudden, they've reduced all these licenses down to just those that are fishing now, and nobody else is going to come in and compete against me. And I appreciate that fact, and I appreciate what they're looking at. Well, what I don't appreciate is that we're going to then create another barrier for young and start fishermen to come into the industry. And all we're asking for is reasonable access to these fisheries. And this is as I said earlier, the cod fishery in the Gulf of Alaska really is the last fishery that hasn't been basically given away. And so the resolution, while it's long and lengthy and has lots of whereases, basically says, please don't reduce reasonable access to these fishermen. Please don't put these endorsements on and make all of the rest of these 800 or 500 and some permits non-usable. And so that's what we're asking for, and that's the message I'm trying to take to the council. The when the council is looking at this, there's a number of options, and then there's all that they already have under their books that they're looking at. But there's also a number of options that they're not looking at. And part of our goal is to raise the awareness on some of these options they may not be looking at. How do you control the growth of these fisheries so you don't get into this issue where you have to have some kind of a limited program or a rationalized program of too many boats, too many people rushing out and killing themselves chasing for a fish. So there's ways they can do that. There's ways they can manage these fisheries and not do that. But under the current system, their answer is just to reduce the access so that there's only X amount of boats that will ever fish in that fishery. So with that, I'm willing to answer questions and to get in this. And obviously, the fisheries is never a controversial issue.
No, but, never.
And in these halls, we get into those controversies quite frequently. And we get into those issues dealing with the State Board of Fisheries. And one of the things that we as legislators, and it's been something that I've done for the 8 years that I was in prior to me coming back now, was stay away from the Board of Fisheries. And the allocation issues that are there, we abrogated those responsibilities to the Board of Fish to manage our resources, fish resources, and game resources. During the 8 years that I was here prior, I also looked at the federal side and said, well, that's just federal fisheries, don't worry about it, we're not going to get involved. And then I left the legislature and spent 4 years working for the governor, and he sent me to every one of those meetings, and he sent me to the international meeting. And so it was very interesting to see, and it was quite an eye-opener for me, and that's one of the reasons that I'm here today sitting in front of you. The eye-opener was that the administration, through the Department of Fish and Games Commissioner, and the five appointees from the governor were making policy calls that directly affected Alaskans. Policy calls in the federal fishery that were putting Alaskans out of work. And the crab rationalization program is a prime example of that, where over 1,000 jobs were lost. And probably half of those were lost in Alaska, and the other half were lost from the West Coast states who were coming up here and fishing. So I think, and what I got out of that 4 years of working for the governor was that this State of Alaska, through its legislature, definitely should be involved in these policy issues that affect Alaskans so greatly. And this issue with the cod in the Central Gulf or in the Western Gulf of Alaska directly affects every community on the Gulf of Alaska, and it directs and definitely affects numerous fishermen. We were doing some work on trying to come up with the matter of the permits, the 65% of the permits that would have been lost if they had gone ahead and abolished those. 425 active commercial fishermen in the state of Alaska today are part of the ownership of those permits that will be lost. They may not be fishing cod, but they have that LLP right now that would be taken away from them either through the endorsement or to the abolishment of those latent permits. So it is an issue that is very contentious in my community, and it's not going to be easy for the next 2 years going back and then running for office again, but this is the right thing to do, and I would appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Osterman. Questions? Okay, we appreciate your testimony. If you can stand by, that would be great. We're going to go ahead and walk through the public that's signed up to testify. Next, we have Don Bremner. Welcome to Senate Resources.
Thank you. I have copies.
Okay. Shalom. Okay.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Don Bremner. I am representing the Central Council Tsingitaida Indian Tribes of Alaska here to support HJR 21. We see this as an opportunity to influence control over Alaska's seafood resources. We participated extensively at the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council level, opposing just this type action of the council to take another step towards rationalization. We've gone, talked blue in the face. with just limited success, like with the CQE program, where they authorized formation of nonprofits in southeast of Alaska that would have the right to buy and lease halibut and sable fish. We've had limited success with the council up there with authorizing the CQEs to obtain permits to lease to halibut charter vessels. So our participation down here is along the same lines we have always spoken for, our villages with the right to access fisheries. And we've worked with the fellows from Kodiak and up north over the years. And we believe, you look at the 34 whereases, the folks on the House side did a real extensive job in justifying why why this should be supported. And their three therefore be resolves are pretty clear. So we just want to submit for the record that when the Magnuson-Stevens Act passed in 1976, it was designed for us, the average person in the street, the average fisherman from the village and the communities, Alaskan residents. They Americanized it, but what really happened after that, the big open ocean fishermen, a little bit smarter than us, they went and got more laws passed, which benefited them. And that's where all this rationalization comes from. And it's at the expense of the inshore fisheries and the inshore communities. And the race for fish switched from foreign fishermen to big guys against little guys on the beach. So I think this is a good thing for the Senate side to take action and say, well, okay, we agree with you folks. I mean, you know, enough is enough. You know, that was the idea behind, like, the stimulus package and all these other things that you're addressing this session to try to help the little guy in the street. That's what it should be all about. And hopefully that's what the Senate side will do as well in supporting something like this. And we just throw our voice behind this resolution. So thank you. And thank you for holding this hearing. You know, the 90-day session cut out a lot of public testimony. And it's a good thing. So thank you for allowing me to speak here today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bremner. And we do have a copy of your testimony, which will be included in the packet.
Thank you.
Okay, next we'll go over to Kodiak and start with Sean Docterman.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chairman McGuire and Wachowski and the Senate Resource members. I'm Sean Docterman, a second-generation commercial fisherman from Kodiak with over 30 years fishing experience. I'm representing my own interests in the Gulf of Alaska fisheries today, even though I am frequently a public advocate for many Alaskan fishermen, their families, and coastal communities. I'm here in support of HJR 21. I'm in opposition to the removal of the LLPs from the Gulf of Alaska ground fish license holders and to the implementation of Pacific Cod endorsement requirements by the council. I think that the council should stick with status quo for the Gulf of Alaska ground fish management. Today I just got off the phone a couple hours ago with a member of the council, and I was talking to him about the legislature working on pushing this bill through to stop the North Pacific Council to stop final action. And I didn't get very far, and in a nutshell, they told me that this thing was going to go through anyway. And I have a hard time realizing why this council does not listen to the stakeholders that are involved. There are over 17 native villages or organizations that back this bill and resolution. And I'm gonna run through a little bit here. The purpose and needs statement of this bill is flawed. There's no increased market value. In fact, the price has dropped almost 50%. And it goes on to tell about that there's intense competition and that what's wrong with competition? So I have a problem with the purpose and needs statement here. And the major problem I have is that this will not ensure that active fishermen will be able to participate in these fisheries, because it will be given to vessel owners that could possibly be not owner on board. And when you take 500 permits out of the 800 and give it to a group of 300, that's like giving them a golden key to the resource. And if they don't have to participate, that's an investor fishery. And that's what really bothers me. In fact, the Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Act was brought forward for conservation, sustainability of resource and habitat protection. So where is it in this bill, in this final action of this program where they're attributing it to that? This is for economic allocations, and that's in violation of National Standard 5, if anybody understands that. They were written in the Sustainable Fisheries Act of 1996 to protect any of these kind of actions coming before the fishermen. You know, the next generation of fishermen is now sitting at the table, and we've had enough fisheries access removal. And so it needs to stop here. And in summary, removing the latent licenses from Gulf groundfish permit holders will leave the state waters as the dumping ground for new entrants. Why shouldn't federal waters have a place for active fishermen as new entrants to transition into for all fisheries? At this point, it's not financially viable to actually go out and fish. In fact, I've been out jigging lately, and with the low prices, it looks like I'm fishing for my sanity first and for an income second. So I'll finish up here. Fishing rights need to remain with those who go out on boats. Removing the LLPs from fixed gear fishermen will simply take rights from active and future fishermen and give exclusive rights to an investor-only faction who do not fish. As always, I appreciate the time you've taken to listen to my comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Doctorman. We appreciate your testimony. Next, I'm going to go to DJ Vinberg there in Kodiak. Are you there, Mr. Vinberg?
I guess I am.
Do you want to go ahead and state your name and on behalf of who you're affiliated with and offer your testimony?
Thank you. My name is DJ Vinberg. I have fished in Kodiak area for 40 years. I'm a third generation fisherman and own and operate the same boat, now called the Family Pride, as my father before me. With all respect to Sean before me and others, I am opposed to HJR 21. Morally, I agree with the open fishing concept, but I live and fish in a real world, and I've felt the impact of rationalization for 14 years. The race for history is on. Pandora's box is open, and those of us with a long history in Kodiak are not protected. With relatively no restrictions, our cod fishing is rapidly becoming a derby-style fishery, not unlike halibut fishing of the past. A cod season used to last 3 or 4 months. This year is 26 days, and 30 more boats than 2 years ago participated. Boats came from the West Coast due to depressed Dungey economy. A large portion were longliners from the peninsula. And most disturbing to me were the larger boats from out west who have crab IFQs. They made their deal with the devil, whether they wanted to or not, who are now free to participate in any open fishery at no risk. They're already bank crab money. In an open fishing environment, these highly competitive operations will be rewarded with a bonus season at my expense. The cod fishing represents 50% of my yearly income. The 2009 length of time for a fishing federal cod season was reduced to 26 days, and the state cod season to 14 days. This has put me in survival mode. If left unchecked, our cod fishery will be overcapitalized. I personally feel that there should be more restrictions on access to our cod fishery and definitely some qualifying years set in place. The 800-plus LLP permits in the Central Gulf is a joke and does nothing to protect me or boats like me who live in Kodiak and who are totally committed to the fishery and spend 100% of my income in Kodiak. My options are limited to Kodiak. I'm too small to chase cod out west. My business is in jeopardy if my piece of the cod pie, quote-unquote, continues to shrink. Some hard choices have to be made. You cannot privatize big chunks of our Alaskan fisheries, thus protecting those participants, and leave the rest of us who are not so lucky totally exposed. While not in favor of further privatization, our IFQs, I think a limited number of permits is a good tool to start with, and throw out any LLPs with no recency. Like the salmon industry, permit holders must be on board and super exclusiveness enforced. There should be consideration for the Ryans and the Franks and the Shawns who have a history in the crab fishery to be allowed to upgrade to a more competitive operation throw out the size limitations associated with any LLPs. While I appreciate the opportunity to express my concerns about the future of my livelihood, I'm also concerned about the Alaska Legislature's ability to undermine the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. I think you should be concerned about our fisheries and knowledgeable about our situation, but at the same time, be respectful of those whose sole responsibility is to make fishery management decisions. If you do not trust them, why should I? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vinberg. Next, we'll go to Al Birch.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Alvin Birch. I'm the owner of The Dawn and The Dusk. I'm also the executive director of the Alaska Whitefish Crawlers Association. I believe you have my packets in front of you in your folders. I'll read today's letter. Dear committee members, I graduated from Seward High School in 1958. I've been an Alaskan fisherman all my adult life. 40 of those years have been spent fishing Kodiak waters, almost all gear types and all species of fish. I'm very familiar with the fisheries management issues, especially those handled by the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. I served on the MPFC advisory panel for 27 years. My concerns about HJR 21 are numerous, but I am especially concerned about the precedent it sets by having the Alaska Legislature make a quick decision about a fisheries issue that has and is going through the long public process that is part of the MPFMC process. Supporters of the resolution say the MPFC plan blocks entry into the cod fisheries. This is far from the truth and is an example of why it is so important to have a long decision-making process for fisheries issues, so all sides and opinions can be weighed and balanced against scientific data. And I really need to emphasize scientific data. That's, without that, we won't have a successful survival of any of the fishes. The MPFC recency amendment package allows new entrants to the fisheries while also protecting those who have a long history of fishing cod like myself and Mr. Vinberg. The package is a result of a long process of public testimony, scientific input, and many months of deliberation. The package is necessary to keep cod from being overfished by too many fishermen going after a limited amount of cod. It also prevents people from taking a fishery away from those who have traditionally fished and who actually developed the fishery from scratch and work to maintain it so that there is a healthy fisheries for the newcomers to enter. I also have a letter from the association. It's similar to that, but I think I'm out of time. I'm hard of hearing, so I don't know if the bell went off or not.
It's just about to. Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Birch.
And I'd be glad to answer questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions? Okay, we appreciate your testimony. And the last person I have there in Kodiak is Peter Allen. Are you there, Mr. Allen?
Yes, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Oh, hi. My name is Peter Allen, and I'd like to thank the House for putting this resolution together, and I hope the Senate will go along with it. I've been fishing a small boat around Kodiak for more than 25 years, and I've been able to do that because of the flexibility that the environment around here and the different fish stocks have allowed. Markets go up, markets go down, fish stocks go up, and fish stocks go down. And the flexibility, I'm not like Mr. Birch. He's pretty much a trawl fisherman, and he has been for years. And I think it's treated him well. But most small boats around here do a lot of different things, and they need that flexibility. Right now, I own an inactive LP. I also have an inactive salmon seine permit, an inactive herring gill net permit, and an inactive crab permit. All these permits are part of my business and part of the flexibility of my business. If the state decides to you know, if the feds are going to take away my cod fishing rights, and then if the state decides to start taking away my other fishing rights, I'm basically out of business. So I hope you'll go, you know, this isn't, what you're trying to do here, this resolution isn't telling the council what to do, but it is telling the council what the representatives of a lot of the people in the state feel, and I think it's right on. And so I would like for you to pass this, and I hope that you will allow me to continue to adapt and keep my business going. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Allen. Okay, next, the Anchorage LEO. I have three more individuals to testify. We're bumping up against our committee deadline here, so 3 minutes to each of you. Mr. Tony Gregario.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm trying to be as brief as possible. I'm from Chicmac, born and raised in Perryville. I lived in Chicmac for years, fished there since 1959. And when guys keep talking about rationalization, I can't help to think back in the early 60s when Del Monte owned all the boats in the Chicmac area. And if you were lucky enough to get a boat, they tell you how much you could catch that day. And every time people talk about rationalization, that's what I keep thinking about. I mean, the companies own the fish, they own the rights, and that's where we're going back to. And in the 50s, we had all these the companies that owned all these fish traps and stuff. And this is the same thing we're going back to. Now, one of the guys that was testifying was talking about he's been doing it for years. I said, look at the villages of Squaw Harbor, Unga, Chicmac Lagoon, that they used to have private the saltries, and that's what they did. When the cod fishing died out, they went to something else. Now those villages are Squaw Harbor and Unga, and those are gone. And we're trying to keep this thing from history repeating itself. It put us back in the Stone Age, and I applaud Osterman and these guys for having the guts to put this thing up through the legislature, because trying to deal with the North Pacific is like trying to tell your wife not to go shopping anymore.
A lot of sympathetic nods.
Okay. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gregario. We appreciate your testimony. Okay, next, in Anchorage, Freddie Christensen.
Yeah, good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon.
My name is Freddie Christensen. I reside in Anchorage now, but I was born and raised in Old Harbor, which is on Kodiak Island. Fished my entire life. I can, you know, it'd probably take a long time for me to tell everything I want to say, but just in a nutshell, I think it's, you know, there comes a point in time when, you know, state needs to stand up and say enough is enough. And these communities, last time I checked, that the state was responsible for these communities to continue to exist. And I don't think that the communities are asking, you know, for any kind of a handout. They're just asking for, to, you know, take, be considerate towards the needs of these communities when, you know, the last of the fish is going to be rationalized. I just feel that there needs to be some, there is ways of making sure that these communities can continue to exist, and you know, with the their economic needs. It's you know, we were raised where we always participated, as Mr. Allen from Kodiak said. We multi-species fish, where we fish salmon, we fish herring, we fish crab, and you know, it's very limited now on what you can participate in. And as we continue down that road, there's really not going to be anything left for the future of the people in the communities. And I guess I'll just leave you with this quote that I, actually not a quote, it was sent out by the NOAA chief, newly appointed chief of NOAA, Jane Lubinko, says, NOAA needs to lead the way towards vibrant coastal communities. And she continues to say that she knows that what Americans want from the ocean, it boils down to clean beaches, safe and healthy seafood, abundant wildlife, stable fisheries and underlying vibrant coastal communities, not just for now, but into the future to share with our kids and grandkids. That's where we need to go, and no one needs to lead the way. So they already are saying that what needs to be done, and I guess I commend Osterman and everybody else participating in this resolution, and I hope that you guys pass it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Christensen. Next, we'll go to Stephen Toffin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Stephen Toffin, Groundswell Fisheries Movement, an advocacy representing citizen taxpayers in fisheries in the United States. Earlier, one of the testifiers outlined for you a purpose and need statement that the council bases its action on. And that's usually preceded by the definition of a problem, and then an outline of those purpose and needs, which Mr. Stockman did a good job of telling you are inaccurate at this point and inappropriate. One that was left out is that the argument for this cod endorsement now eschews efficiencies. It criticizes efficiencies, but that's been used for every other privatization program as a reason to do it. But because a few fishermen got smart and figured out what to do with their boats, some of these players didn't like it. Well, and it's a schizoid kind of thinking. It represents that this council is nothing but hell-bent on privatization. They just can't stop, even when things become disconnected from reality. And that's why the Gulf of Alaska fishermen are in this survival mode. But it's possible to turn back these rationalization schemes. They are not rational. They have nothing to do with that kind of thing. They're based on the word ration, you know, dividing up. And anyway, I believe there's a lot of reasons why the legislature should be involved in the council action. Number one, to ensure that these problem statements and purpose and needs statements are accurate and sensible before regulatory reviews are done. And number two, I have suggested before that the state even have a deputy attorney general represent our constitutional rights and ensure that our coastal communities are protected, and that small businessmen and other stakeholders among the common people are represented. I applaud Mr. Osterman. I support this resolution, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else online that I've overlooked wishing to testify in HJR 21? Is there anyone here in the audience? Okay, hearing and seeing none, then we'll close public testimony on House Joint Resolution 21 and set the resolution aside. Thank you very much for your testimony, and for those who were online today from the public, we appreciate it. And with that, we're adjourned.